Pacifica. This is Democracy Now!
You embarrass me in this hotel.
I'm not embarrassing you. It's just that I don't feel comfortable.
I mean, don't have a fight with me.
It's not anything.
Please, I'm not going to do anything. I swear, my children, please come in. On everything, I'm a famous guy.
I'm feeling very uncomfortable right now.
Please come in now. And 1 minute, and if you want to leave, when the guy comes with my jacket,
why yesterday you touched my wrist?
Please, I'm sorry. Just come on. I'm used to that.
But you're used to that?
Yes, come in.
No, but I'm not used to that.
Movie mogul Harvey Weinstein is fired by his own company as more and more women come forward accusing him of harassment, sexual assault, and rape. We'll speak with Louise Godbold. She wrote the piece, My Encounter with Harvey Weinstein and What It Tells Us About Trauma. And we'll talk to Colorado College psychology professor Tomi Ann Roberts, who'll describe her encounter with Weinstein more than 30 years ago. She now focuses on psychological consequences of the sexual objectification of women and girls. And we'll talk to journalist and author Irene Carmon, who says women shouldn't trust the men who call themselves allies. Then, as NBC News reports, President Trump called for a nearly tenfold increase in the U.S. nuclear weapons arsenal. Is President Trump taking us to war? Military pundits say yes.
I think, Brian, inescapably, we are sliding toward war. I think part of the problem is going to be the North Koreans over the last 50 years have learned they can provoke, talk, gain compensation, and provoke again.
Meanwhile, the U.S. is struggling to recover from a series of hurricanes, and a 10th hurricane this year, Ophelia, has just been named, as fires consume Northern California. We'll speak with Robert J. Lifton, author of more than 20 books about the effects of nuclear war, terrorism, and genocide. His new book is titled The Climate Swerve, Reflections on Mind, Hope, and Survival. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In California, the death toll from the wildfires burning statewide has risen to 23 people, with hundreds more still missing. The nearly two dozen fires have consumed more than 170,000 acres, destroyed thousands of structures, forced tens of thousands of people to flee their homes. More than 8,000 firefighters are currently battling the blazes, working up to 80 hours straight. Among them are prisoners who are working for as little as a dollar a day. The firefighters have more than 500 fire engines, 73 helicopters, 30 airplanes, yet the uncontrollable fires are still spreading. Cal Fire Chief Ken Pimlott said, quote, these fires are literally just burning faster than firefighters can run. This is Chief Pimlott.
We are still impacted by 5 years of drought. With the significant rain that we had last winter, those effects are gone of that moisture, and we are literally looking at explosive vegetation. These fires are burning actively during the day and at night when one would expect a fire to subside. And make no mistake, this is a serious, critical, catastrophic event.
Some of the most destructive fires are in Northern California's Sonoma County, where officials are investigating Pacific Gas and Electric Company power lines as the potential source of the fire. On Sunday nights, as the fires began, there were multiple reports of downed power lines and exploding electrical transformers. Pacific Gas and Electric Company's failure to properly maintain its power lines has sparked fires in the past, including the 2015 fire that killed two people. President Trump has threatened to retaliate against NBC following its report that Trump is seeking a tenfold increase in the U.S. nuclear weapons arsenal. On Wednesday, Trump tweeted, quote, with all of the fake news coming out of NBC and the networks, at what point is it appropriate to challenge their license? Bad for country, he tweeted. The federal government licenses television airwaves through the FCC. Trump went on to tweet, network news has become so partisan, distorted, and fake that licenses must be challenged and, if appropriate, revoked. not fair to public, he tweeted. The threats drew immediate concerns. Trump is undermining the First Amendment. This is constitutional lawyer Floyd Abrams.
The idea of any president saying that broadcast licenses ought to be at risk because he disapproves of their news coverage raises really dangerous First Amendment issues. This is unadulterated Richard Nixon. This is precisely the sort of thing that the Nixon administration did, threatening broadcasters with antitrust actions, threatening them with taking their license away, all to get better coverage. And it's the most direct sort of threat to the First Amendment that President Trump has made since he was sworn in.
The magazine Vanity Fair reports some of President Trump's closest aides and advisors say he's unstable and unraveling, and that the White House is increasingly consumed by chaos. According to the article, former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon reportedly said he thinks Trump has only a 30% chance of finishing his first term, and that the threat is the 25th Amendment, the right for cabinet members to vote to remove the president. When Bannon mentioned the 25th Amendment to Trump, the president reportedly said, "What's that?" Meanwhile, The Washington Post reports one of Trump's closest friends, Tom Barrack, says he's shocked by Trump's behavior. World leaders, senior U.S. officials, and U.S. lawmakers are all pressuring President Trump not to decertify the landmark 2015 nuclear deal with Iran, which Trump is expected to do as early as Friday. Among those pressuring Trump is former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, known as an anti-Iran hawk, who nevertheless is calling the proposed withdrawal a mistake. U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis has also urged Trump to stick with the deal, and the Trump administration itself has certified that Iran has complied with its obligations. In Hollywood, new revelations about Harvey Weinstein have surfaced, showing his studio, Weinstein Company, knew for at least 2 years that he'd been paying off women who accused him of sexual harassment and assault. Weinstein has been fired from the company as a slew of women have come forward to accuse him of sexual harassment, assault, and rape. Among his accusers are some of Hollywood's top actresses, Ashley Judd, Gwyneth Paltrow, Angelina Jolie, and Rose McGowan. Many are now asking why Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance refused to prosecute Weinstein after he confessed to groping Filipina-Italian model Ambra Batalana Gutierrez in an audio recording captured in a New York police sting operation in 2015. One of Weinstein's lawyers at the time donated $10,000 to Vance's election campaign only days after Vance decided not to prosecute the case. We'll have more on Harvey Weinstein after headlines. In Syria, the U.S.-led coalition fighting ISIS and Raqqa said Wednesday it will not accept a negotiated withdrawal to end the fighting in the northeastern Syrian city that was once ISIS's de facto capital. Thousands of civilians remain trapped in the 2.5 square miles still controlled by ISIS. Activists say more than 1,000 civilians have already been killed since the U.S.-led offensive to seize control of the city began in June. The journalistic monitoring group Air War says dozens of civilians have reportedly been killed in the last week, including in a barrage of airstrikes October 6, which reportedly collapsed a number of apartment buildings, killing up to 40 people. Meanwhile, in eastern Syria, tens of thousands of civilians have been displaced by fighting against ISIS in Deir ez-Zor. This is Ala speaking from a makeshift camp.
Papers started falling on us from a plane, saying to go to the first camp and surrender yourself, and that you will feel safety there and receive medicine and medical care to sick children, that you just have to wave the white flag. We did as they told us and showed up. On the road, I encountered landmines and suffered from cold and hunger. This road is called the Death Road. And if we stay here, this is death.
President Trump says he plans to nominate Kirstjen Nielsen to serve as the next Homeland Security Secretary. John Kelly, Trump's previous Homeland Security Secretary, now serves as Trump's chief of staff. Nielsen's a longtime DHS official, recently serving as Kelly's chief of staff. Under President George W. Bush, she was the senior director for preparedness and response at the White House Security Council ahead of Hurricane Katrina. She was subsequently singled out in congressional reports as one of the key figures in the Bush administration administration, who had been warned about the impending catastrophe of Katrina but failed to act. She's also worked in the for-profit security industry, first as a firm called Civitas Group and then founding the security firm Sunsys Consulting. The Boy Scouts have announced they plan to accept girls into the program beginning next year. This comes after the Boy Scouts first ended its ban on openly gay Boy Scouts and then transgender Scouts. And today, the state of Texas is planning to execute Robert Pruitt. He's been in prison since he was 15 years old. He was sentenced to death for the murder of prison guard Daniel Nagel. He's always maintained his innocence, saying he was framed by corrupt prison guards. There's no physical evidence tying him to the murder. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nareen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Today, we look at the fallout from two shocking investigations by The New Yorker and The New York Times, which revealed a slew of rape and sexual assault allegations against disgraced and now fired movie producer Harvey Weinstein, who had been one of the most powerful men in Hollywood for decades. Weinstein has also been a major contributor to the Democratic Party. This week, The New Yorker reported three women say Harvey Weinstein raped them, while more say Weinstein masturbated in front of them or forcibly touched them without their consent. Among the accusers is former aspiring actress Lucia Evans, who says she had just finished her junior year at Middlebury College when she was invited to a daytime meeting with Weinstein at the Miramax office. She said he pushed her head down and, quote, "forced me to perform oral sex on him. I said over and over, I don't want to do this. Stop. Don't. I tried to get away. He's a big guy. He overpowered me," unquote. Another woman, who was not named, says Weinstein forced himself on her during a meeting and raped her while she repeatedly said no. Like others in the article, she says she did not report the alleged rape and forced herself to continue to have professional contact with Weinstein because, quote, "I was in a vulnerable position and I needed my job. It just increases the shame and the guilt," unquote. The article also reveals audio from a 2015 NYPD sting operation in which Weinstein confesses to groping Filipina-Italian model Ambra Batilana Gutierrez. The recording starts with Weinstein.
I'm telling you right now.
What do we have to do here?
Nothing. I'm going to take a shower. You sit there and have a drink. Water.
Don't drink. Can I stay on the bar?
No. You must come here now.
No.
Please.
No, I don't want to.
I'm not doing anything with you.
I know.
You're embarrassing me.
I'm sorry. I cannot. No, yesterday was a kind of aggressive for me.
I need
to know a person to be touched.
I won't do a thing.
I don't
do a thing. If you embarrass me in this hotel,
I'm not embarrassing you.
It's just
that I don't feel comfortable.
I mean, don't have a fight with me in the hall. Please, I'm not going to do anything. I swear, my children, please come in. On everything, I'm a famous guy.
I'm feeling very uncomfortable right now.
Please come in now, and 1 minute. And if you want to leave, when the guy comes with my jacket,
you can go. Why yesterday you touched my breast?
Oh, please, I'm sorry. Just come on. I'm used to that.
But you're used to that?
Yes, come in.
No, but I'm not used to that.
I won't.
While this was from an NYPD sting operation, no charges were brought. On Wednesday, Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance defended his office's decision not to prosecute Weinstein.
If we had a case that we felt we could prosecute, and my experts felt we could prosecute against Harvey Weinstein, we would have. We take on many, many, many difficult sex crime prosecutions with individuals, irrespective of their background or their money. So that's not an issue for us. We really are based on the facts, not what people think about it, not whether people liked Harvey or not or didn't. Obviously, he has some serious issues, and the tape is terrible. But I, as DA, have to be guided by the evidence and the elements of the crime.
The New York Times reports Harvey Weinstein was represented in talks with the district attorney's office by two defense lawyers with ties to Cy Vance. One of Weinstein's lawyers at the time donated $10,000 to Vance's election campaign only days after Vance decided not to prosecute the case. The New Yorker reports 16 current or former employees of Weinstein's companies say they personally knew about Weinstein's assaults or harassment. Today, the New York Times reported Weinstein's company has been aware of several confidential settlements he made with women since 2015. Meanwhile, a slew of Hollywood's most high-profile actresses have told The New York Times they, too, experienced Weinstein's harassment, among them Ashley Judd, Gwyneth Paltrow, Angelina Jolie, Rose McGowan, Pulp Fiction star Rosanna Arquette. Paltrow said, quote, "We're at a point in time when women need to send a clear message that this is over. This way of treating women ends now," unquote. On Wednesday, Rose McGowan reported her Twitter account had been suspended after she used it to support other women who have come forward and to attack those she saw as complicit, including the Weinstein Company board of directors and high-profile actors Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. McGowan accused Affleck of lying about his knowledge of Weinstein's history of sexual misconduct. Weinstein's wife, Georgina Chapman, and a well-known fashion designer, says she's ending their 10-year marriage. On Tuesday, former President Barack Obama and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton broke their silence and both condemned Weinstein, who is a major Democratic donor. In a statement, Obama said he and his wife Michelle have been disgusted by the reports and said, quote, "Any man who demeans and degrades women in such fashion needs to be condemned and held accountable regardless of wealth or status," unquote. For more, we are joined by several guests. Joining us via Democracy Now! Video stream from Colorado is Tomianne Roberts, a professor of psychology at Colorado College, who says she was harassed by Harvey Weinstein more than 30 years ago, in 1984, when she was an aspiring actress. Her work focuses on the psychological consequences of the sexual objectification of women and girls. In Los Angeles, we're joined by Louise Godbold, who wrote about her experience with Weinstein in a blog post titled "My Encounter with Harvey Weinstein and What It Tells Us About Trauma." She's now executive director of Echo Parenting and Education. And here in New York, Irene Carmon, contributing writer at The Washington Post. Her piece is headlined, "Women Shouldn't Trust the Men Who Call Themselves Allies." She's also the author of the New York Times bestseller, Notorious RBG, The Life and Times of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Tomianne Roberts, let's begin with you. We're going to talk about the work you now do on the sexual objectification in girls and women. But let's begin with what happened to you more than 30 years ago in 1984. How did you come in contact with Harvey Weinstein?
Well, the stories are beginning to sound monotonous, right? And chillingly familiar. I was waiting tables. I was a student at Smith College, and several friends and I had decided to spend the summer in New York City pursuing our dreams. And so we sublet an apartment, and I was waiting tables at a restaurant, and that's where I met both Bob and Harvey Weinstein. They were relative newcomers on the scene, explained to me their new company, Miramax. And pretty soon I was given to believe that I might be someone who could audition for a movie that they were going to be writing and directing. And it would have been the first movie they were writing and directing here in the United States. And so I thought to myself, such a new company might not take such a new unknown person for granted. And so I decided that I would try to audition for that movie. So throughout the course of the summer, I would receive scripts and script updates. I did visit the office on an occasion. And then I was invited to what I believe was Harvey's apartment. And my expectation, of course, was that others involved in the movie would be there as well. And that turned out not to be the case. And it was in this down a rather darkened hallway that I discovered him in the bathtub. And that encounter, as you might imagine, was petrifying to a 20-year-old. I sort of stood there frozen. And Mr. Weinstein was quite calm about trying to explain to me that if I would at least take my top off, this would demonstrate to him that I wasn't going to be shy about doing so in front of the cameras. The movie was likely to have topless scenes. And looking back, as I've said in several interviews now, I'm slightly ashamed to think that the only way I could imagine getting out of there was not running, but rather politely and sort of self-effacingly apologizing for the fact that I didn't feel comfortable with that. And so I did eventually exit, and found a payphone, called my boyfriend, and basically threw my acting aspirations in the wastebasket.
You had actually gone back to one of your tryouts, your auditions, that where they said that you were moving forward and they told you they weren't interested anymore, Weinstein's Company?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was Weinstein's Company. It was a casting agent. At the time, I was so frightened because of the previous experience that I convinced one of my housemates to come with me, a rather larger young man. And once we got there, it was pretty clear that Harvey himself, neither Harvey nor Bob were going to be there. And the casting agent was a very kind older woman who just sort of said to me, you know, you're not getting this part, right? And I did do the reading and felt pretty lousy about it. And that was about the end of that.
Well, Tomian Roberts, you talk about feeling ashamed for apologizing as you left. But, you know, one of the things that's so extraordinary about your experience is, in fact, that you did have the wherewithal and the kind of gumption to actually walk out. Because, as you point out, women who find themselves in these situations are so shocked at what actually occurs that they're frozen. So could you explain a little bit, you know, you can talk about your experience, but more generally, how it is that women respond or what it is that prevents women in so many instances from acting the way that they retrospectively feel they should have acted.
Right, right. I think that that's probably something that a clinical psychologist would have a lot to say about the kinds of things that can happen when, you know, we know that there are a number of different reactions to shock. And one would be to fight, one would be to flee, but the other is to freeze. And I think that freeze response is so flooding. It's so overwhelming. And I think that once you consider the age and the power differential in these kinds of situations, so many women describe a similar way of exiting, which is that you sort of put it on yourself. You very politely, you tap into all the feminine socialization that's been part of your life since you were called a pretty little girl, and you apologize. You say that this is something about you, not something about him, this powerful man who might otherwise retaliate, and you bow out, backing your way to the door, and you find that your only, quote, power in the situation is to appear to be someone who's just not really up for this. And I think that that's a way of not poking the bear, right? That's a way of trying to say, it's me, not you, but I'm getting out of here.
Tomian Roberts, very quickly, before we talk about another experience and then have this broader discussion, what was your response now, more than 30 years later, when you started reading the accounts of women who describe very similar encounters or much more serious? The New Yorker piece by Rowan Farrow begins, three women are claiming rape. What did you think today?
So, so chilling. I, you know, I've carried this with me for so long, and it's, and I'm not a person who's involved in Hollywood. I went on and got my PhD. I live my life in academia. There were never very many opportunities other than maybe at an Oscars party where you're hanging out with friends and here comes Harvey Weinstein on the stage and I have a little wool inside. When that piece came out on Thursday by Jody Kantor, it was just, it opened
the
something up
in
me. And I wrote an email to Jody and I thought there's never in a million years she's going to read this. Certainly not. I opened the email by saying I'm not an actress. I'm a 54-year-old college professor. This is going to sound crazy, but this happened to me. So it was a real opening for me. And it was a way of me looking back at the whole narrative arc of this, at the ways in which for the rest of my scholarly life, I've really, really been moved and motivated to study these things and to try to help stop this kind of treatment. As Gwyneth Paltrow so wonderfully said, this way of treating girls and women ends now.
We're going to go to break and come back. We want you to stay with us. Tomianne Roberts, professor of psychology at Colorado College, who describes her experience being harassed by Harvey Weinstein back in 1984 when she was an aspiring actress. That put an end to those aspirations. But now she looks at the objectification of girls and women in her psychological research. When we return, another experience and then a broader discussion. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
You tell me it gets better in time. You say I pull myself together, pull it together, you'll be fine. Tell me what the hell do you know, what do you know? Tell me how the hell could you know? Hold your head up and be strong. 'Cause when you fall, you gotta get up. You gotta get up.
Happens to You by Lady Gaga, who co-wrote the song with Diane Warren for the 2015 documentary The Hunting Ground about sexual assault on college campuses. The film was distributed by the Weinstein Company, which Harvey Weinstein co-founded. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We continue our look at the fallout from two shocking investigations by The New Yorker and The New York Times, which revealed a slew of rape and sexual assault allegations against disgraced and now fired movie producer Harvey Weinstein, who had been one of the most powerful men in Hollywood for decades. Weinstein has also been a major contributor to the Democratic Party.
We are joined by Tomianne Roberts, who you just heard, professor of psychology now at Colorado College, who describes her experience in 1984 with Harvey Weinstein when she was an aspiring actress in Los Angeles. We're joined by Louise Godbold, who wrote about her experience with Weinstein in a blog post that was entitled My Encounter with Harvey Weinstein and What It Tells Us About Trauma. She's now executive director of Echo Parenting and Education. So can you tell us, Louise Godbold, about what your encounter was and what it tells you about trauma? When did you first meet Harvey Weinstein, the movie mogul who has now been fired? And we'll see what happens. We'll see if, in fact, he will be prosecuted. Scores of women are now coming forward talking about their experiences with him. What happened to you, Louise?
Well, firstly, let me thank you very much, Amy and Nermeen, for creating a safe space to tell this story, because part of the story is what happens when a woman does come forward. And it's been a very interesting journey since that blog came out on Monday. But my experience was, as Tomianne said, chillingly similar to all the other stories. And when I wrote my blog, I didn't actually go into detail. I didn't think it was necessary. The patterns are there, clear to see. And I was also very young. I was 28, but a young 28. And I had met Harvey and Bob socially in London. A friend of mine is an actress, and they were just starting out, and they would come to her brunch parties. And so when I was traveling through New York, I had an appointment with Harvey's PR person to talk about interning in the U.S. And as I went past Harvey's office, I saw him there, and it felt strange not to say hello, especially if I was going to be there as an intern. And that resulted in a tour of the office in Tribeca. and him cornering me in an empty meeting room and putting my hand on his crotch. And I got out of there as fast as I could. And then he called my friend, our mutual friend, to say he apologized. It was the pressure of work. It was coming up to the Academy Awards or something like that. And was I going to do anything about it? And sadly, in the 1990s, that was the last thing on my mind. I felt like this was somebody I had known and who maybe had lurched at me drunkenly at a party, and you kind of shrug it off. So when I was then the next month in Los Angeles, I was invited to his hotel suite, and I thought that he was going to make things right. He knew I was trying to get started in the film industry in the U.S. And fortunately, a friend of mine, a male friend of mine, drove me to the hotel and waited in the lobby because after chatting about the industry, and I would love to know this detail from other women. Did he tell you to read Genius of the System? Because that's what he was telling me to do. And the next thing I know, he's asking for a shoulder massage. I don't remember all the details, but somehow or other, I ended up in his bedroom with him in bed, asking me to do a massage. And then he got up, and that was a sight for sore eyes. I won't go into details. And then he tried to give me a massage. And as Tony Ann said, one of our most primitive survival instincts is to freeze. And I had been frozen, confused, scared, embarrassed, primarily embarrassed. And because I had a friend waiting downstairs in the lobby, I was able to make my excuses and get out of there. And never told anybody, because I did want to get my start in the industry, and it would have been suicide to have said anything. And then I moved on into a different industry and didn't really think very much more about it until I saw the New York Times report. And then when I heard that Harvey wanted to sue the New York Times, that's when I got really angry, because the pattern was so familiar. And I hadn't realized that this had happened to so many women. And so I got mad, and I contacted the lawyer who was representing the person who brought this original case, and wanted to tell my story. So that's how I got involved.
And Louise, you ask in your blog post a question that's very pertinent. First of all, because this practice is so widespread, and not just among extremely powerful men, although in that case it's more silencing to the people who are subject to their sexual violence. You ask in your blog post, why is it that women carry the shame of their abusers? Can you talk about that? Why is that?
I think it's partly conditioning, and that goes back to your childhood. It goes back to this culture of compliance that we have in our parenting, in our education system, and we focus so much on that and not on building relationships and connection, that we end up very vulnerable to either then discovering that the way to get things is by being a bully, which is what happened to Harvey, clearly, or you end up at the other end of that power dynamic where you are more vulnerable to finding yourself in these kind of situations. And the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study has shown that people who've experienced childhood trauma or adversity are much more likely to be victims of sexual assault later. And so you end up one or the other side of this dynamic. And if you're on the side of the person who is being targeted, you feel like it's your fault. And I know that Tony Ann has said that in her reporting of the incidents, that she felt like it was her fault. But there's not a lot to contradict you. They're your friends and family, out of love for you, want to protect you. They tell you, don't say anything. Even as as recently as yesterday, steer clear of this. Keep your nose clean. Don't get involved. And the message is, you will be doing something wrong. At least that's how I perceived it. You will be doing something wrong. You'll be rocking the boat. You will be bringing all the shame upon your head. And if you do, well, you know, that's on you, which is a bit like saying, if you find yourself alone with Harvey, that's on you. Or it's like saying, if you wore that dress, that's on you. And you can extend it all the way back to, and if you're a woman, you should just expect to be a target of men.
I want to ask you about the second part, this issue of trauma, and that's something that you deal with mm-hmm. today. Your piece, My Encounter with Harvey Weinstein, and what it tells us about trauma, if you could expand on that.
Yes, absolutely. We train professionals in trauma-informed care, and Tamian has already covered the three primary responses when you're in survival mode, the fight, flight, freeze. But I think that what I have learned after writing that blog and experiencing the fallout is that we need to educate everybody about trauma so that people can become trauma-informed, not just the friends and family I'm talking about who actively were trying to protect me and suggesting I did not come forward, but also for the media and the way that this story's been handled. I have to tell you, I've been traumatized, re-traumatized by some of the conversations I've had with people wanting interviews. And I know these are good people, and I know that they would be trauma-informed if they could be. They just don't have the information. So, for example, when we train legal advocates who are working with sexual assault survivors, the first thing that you say is, I believe you. And I had an interview with one of the corporate networks who they canceled because the lawyer said, well, you don't have a corroborating story. The reason I don't have a corroborating story is because the person who waited for me in the lobby of the hotel does not want to come forward. And so I went home and after 26 years, cried my eyes out because before I had been a private, embarrassing situation, now I feel like I'm not believed and the shame that comes with that and the anger that comes with that. So I've learned a lot about how we generally need to become more trauma-informed, believing the survivor and offering support. I would have loved someone to say to me, you brave, brave girl, rather than don't do this. Just sit down, shut up.
Well, I wanted to go to one of the people who broke this story, Ronan Farrow. His interview on Tuesday night with MSNBC's Rachel Maddow about why he published his major investigation into Harvey Weinstein in The New Yorker magazine when he's a contributing correspondent to NBC. This was Farrow's response.
You would have to ask NBC and NBC executives about the details of that story. I'm not going to comment on any news organization's story that they, did or didn't run. I will say that over many years, many news organizations have circled this story and faced a great deal of pressure in doing so. Hmm. And there are now reports emerging publicly about the kinds of pressure that news organizations face in this. Mm-hmm. And that is real.
By the way, Ronan Farrow is Mia Farrow's son. For more, I want to bring into this conversation Erin Cormon, who is a journalist and contributing writer at The Washington Post, where she recently published a piece headlined, Women Shouldn't Trust the Men Who Call Themselves Allies. She's also an author of the New York Times bestseller Notorious RBG, The Life and Times of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Erin, talk about why you're raising this issue now and start with what Ronan Farrow just said, this issue of NBC spiked the story.
Amy, the first thing I want to say is I'm astonished by the courage of the women who are talking about this right now. And if you want to see how hard it is, all you have to do is listen to the words that Ronan said. He was able to do something that journalists have been trying to do for a long time, which is publish a story, not just report on a story, but reach to publication a story that documented what is clearly a systemic pattern of abuse from Harvey Weinstein. And one of the reasons that they weren't able to do that is because the standard is so high for corroborating details in a way that often re-victimizes people. And by re-victimizing, by asking for this kind of corroboration, networks are trying to insulate themselves from legal threats. The fact that this is a powerful man who managed to get the best counsel that money could buy, who was extremely well-connected, who effectively bought off people who were an impediment to him, shows what a difficult journey it was just to get these stories to come to light. So I think that that's job number one. You mentioned the hunting ground. I mean, Harvey Weinstein was somebody who, among other people that he sort of bought off or implicated, whether they knew it or not, in the kind of behavior in which he was engaging, are advocates for women's rights. He funded a professorship in Gloria Steinem's name. He went to the Women's March in Utah during the Sundance Film Festival. So on the one hand, you know, for myself as a feminist, I would love to welcome men to this fight. We cannot do it by ourselves. We can't have a one-sided revolution. This has to be something where gender roles are revolutionized for everyone, for a more safe and equal world. But when you have people who are putting on the cloak of gender equality as a way to hide their misdeeds, I think all of us need to stop and say, what truly constitutes an ally? When is somebody just talking the talk and using the good faith of women, which, by the way, we're also socialized to give men the benefit of the doubt, as a cover to abuse us?
Well, I mean, one of the people who has come out against Weinstein is a former employee of his, Lauren O'Connor, who in her letter to several executives at the company run by Weinstein wrote, "I am a 28-year-old woman trying to make a living and a career. Harvey Weinstein is a 64-year-old world-famous man, and this is his company. The balance of power is me, zero, Harvey Weinstein, 10. So, I mean, in addition to, I mean, what are the implications of that? You talked about the fear that media companies have of running stories like this because of fear of legal consequences. But talk about the broader implications of this, the fact that there's such massive power differentials and often age differentials, too, as has been the case with a large number of women who've come forward in this.
Lauren O'Connor's memo, I think, puts it so beautifully. This is all about power. This is about somebody who the very exercise of power against people who are more vulnerable was what appealed to him, not because what we're hearing some of it this week, Harvey liked pretty girls. It is so clear from hearing the accounts that it was the very abuse of power that he was after in these scenarios. I'm really struck by the fact that so many of these women did what victims are told to do. In the civil realm, in the sexual harassment realm, women are told, document everything that happens, tell your superiors. That's what that young woman did, despite the fact that that power dynamic existed. You mentioned Ambra Batilana Gutierrez. This is a woman who came back to a man who had assaulted her, wearing a wire at tremendous danger to herself. And rather than being followed up by prosecution, which is what she clearly hoped for, she saw her own personal record, just the fact that she had previously accused people of assault, dragged through the mud.
I mean, her story is really unbelievable.
Yeah.
She walked out of Harvey Weinstein's place straight to the police station. She said, "I have just been assaulted." They took her seriously. And they said, "We're going to wire you." She went back the next night, and she had this encounter that we played earlier, just a clip of it. It goes on. In the end, the DA, Cy Vance, decided not to prosecute. Now, The Times has a very interesting piece today where it says, Mr. Weinstein was represented in talks with the district attorney's office by two defense lawyers with ties to Mr. Vance, Daniel S. Connolly, a former Manhattan prosecutor, and Elkin Abramowitz, who is Mr. Vance's former law partner and a donor to his campaign. Mr. Vance said on Wednesday the donations had not influenced him.
Whether the donations influenced him or not, I think it's very clear that there were a series of interactions that show how powerful Harvey Weinstein was, whether it was monetary, whether it was influence. I remember one of the reports today mentioned the prosecution of Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who was a very powerful man who was accused of sexual assault, where there was indeed prosecution that was dropped after the victim herself was questioned.
A famous, powerful French politician who could have been president of France.
Absolutely. And the head of the IMF.
Again, we talk about power dynamics. I think any prosecutor wants to bring a case that they know they can win. And it is very difficult to win when someone is able to purchase the best legal counsel that money can buy, when someone is able to purchase the silence. I mean, the way in which nondisclosure agreements and settlements, including with Ms. O'Connor, have been used, and Ms. Batia Gutierrez, these money ultimately was used to silence these women because they realized, probably they made a calculation that if they went through with it, they would end up with even less. But the upshot was that he was available to keep abusing people and continue doing so.
The idea that this is just being known now is obviously completely untrue. We're going to go to break, and we're going to come back and play just a couple of clips. One of them was seen by, I don't know what they say, who watches the Oscars, like a billion people. And the other one from 30 Rock, referring directly to Harvey Weinstein. And then we'll continue our discussion with Irene Carmon of The Washington Post. As well, we'll be joined by two women who describe their own encounters with Harvey Weinstein. Tomianne Roberts, who is now a professor of psychology, who looks at the sexual objectification of girls and women. She's at Colorado College. And Louise Godbold, executive director of Echo Parenting and Education, as she talks about trauma. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Come round by my side, and I'll sing you a song. I'll sing it so softly, it'll do no one wrong. On Birmingham Sunday, the blood ran like wine, and the choirs kept singing of freedom. That cold autumn morning, no eye saw the sun. And Addie Mae Collins, her number was one. At an old Baptist church, there was no need to run. And the choirs kept singing of freedom. Now the clouds, they were gray, and the autumn wind.
Birmingham Sunday by the singer-songwriter Rhiannon Giddens, who just won Genius Grant from the MacArthur Foundation. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. As we continue to talk about Harvey Weinstein, who has just been fired by his board as dozens of women come forward, we continue to look at the fallout from the shocking investigations by The New Yorker and The New York Times, which revealed the slew of rape and sexual assault allegations against disgraced and now fired movie producer Harvey Weinstein, one of the most powerful men in Hollywood for decades. Weinstein, also a major contributor to the Democratic Party. This is a clip from the NBC show 30 Rock in 2012, when the character Jenna, Jane Krakowski, says she isn't afraid of anyone in show business and says she's turned down intercourse with Harvey Weinstein on no less than three occasions.
How long will it take to get a cease and desist order against Weird Al Yankovic? Oh, that's too bad. Did they also take away your handgun license?
Don't do it, J-Mo. You don't want to mess with Weird Al.
Oh, please. I'm not afraid of anyone in show business. I turned down intercourse with Harvey Weinstein on no less than three occasions. Out of five.
And this is a clip of Seth MacFarlane announcing the 2013 Oscar nominations when MacFarlane joked about Harvey Weinstein's behavior.
The 2012 nominees for Best Performance by an Actress in a Supporting Role are Sally Field in Lincoln, Anne Hathaway in Les Miserables, Jackie Weaver in Silver Linings Playbook, Helen Hunt in The Sessions, and Amy Adams in The Master. Congratulations, you five ladies no longer have to pretend to be attracted to Harvey Weinstein.
That was in 2013. Seth MacFarlane has since responded to the resurfacing of his comment. On Wednesday, he tweeted, quote, "In 2011, my friend and colleague Jessica Barth, with whom I worked on the TED films, confided in me regarding her encounter with Harvey Weinstein and his attempted advances. She has since courageously come forward to speak out. It was this account in mind that when I hosted the Oscars in 2013, I couldn't resist the opportunity to take a hard swing in his direction. Make no mistake, this came from a place of loathing and anger. There is nothing more abhorrent and indefensible than abuse of power such as this. I respect and applaud my friend Jessica and those sharing their stories for their decision to come forward and for being champions of the truth." MacFarlane's response drew criticism online. Journalist Andrea Grimes wrote, quote, "MacFarlane's other material, in which the Family Guy creator sexualized a black child, mocked actresses for appearing nude on screen, and turned singer Chris Brown's history of committing domestic violence into a punchline, was widely considered to be more offensive than what appeared then to be a comparatively tame rib about powerful men and aspiring actresses. It was lost back then in a swirl of worse jokes. Only in retrospect does MacFarlane's banal cruelty become apparent, but that's the joke, I guess," Andrea Grimes wrote. Well, this is complicated, and we're going to take it apart right now with our guests. We're joined by Tomianne Roberts, who described her story at the beginning of this hour, professor of psychology in Colorado College, who says she was harassed by Harvey Weinstein in 1984 when she was an aspiring actress, and that ended her aspirations. In Los Angeles, Louise Godbold is with us, wrote about her experience with Weinstein in a blog, "My Encounter with Harvey Weinstein, What It Tells Us About Trauma," who's now executive director of Echo Parenting and Education here in New York. Rian Carmon is the contributing writer and Washington Post writer. Her piece, "Women Shouldn't Trust the Men Who Call Themselves Allies." So your response to 30 Rock, I mean, a billion people is the Oscars or more watching.
It infuriates me, specifically the Seth MacFarlane joke, because I think there's a point at which we should think about rape jokes as such, as follows. Do they punch down? Is the rape victim or potential rape victim the butt of the joke? And I think that yucking it up about how funny it is that women have to pretend to be attracted to a man who was serially abusing them, something that he actually knew at the time.
And said he was enraged by.
Right.
He said he was
that
actually
doesn't sound
expressing
like an
his
expression
loathing.
Of rage to me. It sounds like, ha, 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 this is just the way things are. Girls have to pretend to like these monsters. It sounds like it's a joke at their expense to me.
Absolutely. It's the oldest joke in the world.
Professor of Psychology, Colorado College, Tomianne Roberts, respond.
I'm feeling the same way. It's the oldest joke in the world, as I said. It reinstates the sexist power differential. It's not just Harvey Weinstein 10, me 0. It's, you know, men at the Oscars 10, all women at the Oscars 0. Once you tell a joke like that, it's a joke about men being men. It's a joke about what we all have to assume to be the case, which is that these women had to use their sexualized bodies to get these parts, and now maybe they don't have to anymore. Give me a break.
Well, Tomianne Roberts, I want to ask you about another fact that's emerged with these revelations, namely that, and a very disturbing one, is that Weinstein systematically used women who worked with him or for him to facilitate a number of these liaisons with aspiring and vulnerable actresses who hoped to get work from him. So could you talk about that, the fact that he made his female employees do this work for him. And then the second thing, which a number of people have pointed out, that his sexual abuse was by no means the only kind of abuse he dispensed. He was known for flying into fits of rage and systematically demeaning his employees, both male and female. So talk about those different forms of abuse, how often they go together, and also his use of his female employees for this purpose, who presumably the young actresses would trust more.
I think there are a lot of things going on here, not the least of which is that this is a man who truly objectifies humans. And by objectification, I'm using Martha Nussbaum, the famous philosopher from the University of Chicago's definition. To objectify is to use a human being as a tool, as a means to an end. To sexually objectify is to use a person's sexualized body as the tool that's the means to your end. It seems to me as though what we're talking about with a lot of these women who had to be part of this whole situation, it's Stockholm syndrome, right? You get close to the power so that you aren't going to be the victim of the power. This is the systemic quality of this, right? It's astonishing. It takes a lot of people to carry out 3 decades of this kind of objectification of human beings. And so you're going to have to organize. You're going to have to get the troops around you. The best thing you could do is to have other young women working in the service of this thing. And you convince those other young women in small and sometimes probably great ways that if they do this for you, he's not going to do something bad to you.
What kind of response, Professor Tomianne Roberts, have you gotten since you've come out?
I feel so sorrowful to hear the other interviewees' response of, you know, feeling re-traumatized. I will tell you that I have had, you know, my cell phone hasn't stopped ringing. I haven't gotten a lot of sleep. My email has blown up with people who are interested in hearing this story. I ended up putting an out-of-office reply on my email that said, I don't want to recount the salacious details of this story anymore. You can read them in the New York Times. If you want to talk to me about the larger issues, if you want to talk to me about this way of treating girls and women ends now, then I'm happy. The re-traumatization is so interesting. I really hadn't thought of it, but I think it's the case. My poor mother, who is quite elderly, had to receive a phone call as corroboration. Did she remember me telling her this story in 1984? And that wasn't easy for her. And I think for the most part, I want to say that I have received a lot of support and a lot of cheering. I'm a feminist. I'm part of feminist communities. Feminists have surrounded me and said, way to go.
Irene Carmon, finally, hearing that NBC spiked this story, the New York Times had started a story 10 years ago, but that story did not go forward. What people can learn now and how you think this needs to be dealt with? And I want to end with the response of Louise Godbold in L.A. on how people have responded to you. We have just less than a minute.
I think we have to look at how we normalize this kind of behavior, how these kinds of abuses of power and acceptance of the kind of power dynamic that we've been talking about has become so normal that we don't even see abusive behavior hiding in plain sight. The stories of Harvey Weinstein were all about how he was such a character. He was like an old studio Hollywood head. People did not know the extent of this, but they also didn't know because he continued to make them money, and they would prefer not to find anything out.
Do you think he will go to jail, Harvey Weinstein?
If I had to put
money
on it,
the New Yorker piece started with 3 women claim rape.
I think that there seems to be evidence of a crime, but based on past experience and having been covering this for years and years, I would be very shocked if he saw the inside of a jail cell.
Louise Godbold, you have the last 10 seconds.
I am so glad that I haven't been asked by and pressured by you to recount lurid details. I am not a victim. I am a survivor. And by telling my story, it has empowered me, and I encourage other women to take this situation and turn it around and let it empower them so they can experience post-traumatic growth.
I want to thank you all for being with us, Louise Godbold, Tomi Ann Roberts, as well as Irene Carmon. This is Democracy Now!